Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
With this week's show, we're off to Croydon once more, and the statistic that really jumped out at me from this week's recording was that between 1805 and 1905, Croydon expanded from a population of about 5,000 to a population of well in excess of 100,000. After a growth spurt like that, is it any wonder that the town is a little bit all over the place, if endearingly so? We're roving around town this week. We finished our journeyings off mic at Reeves Corner, where the pharmacy sign remains melted from the heat of the burning furniture shop. Did you know that there were two Reeves establishments, one on either side of a junction? The original one, the more historical building in which the Reeves business grew up, is still extant, and actually you can see a picture of it if you use the Acast platform to listen to this show. Well, let's get underway. It is the 27th of June 2015. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this is Londonist Out Loud.
Hey baby, let me take you down, so we'll play some strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the like before, just a stone through from your front door.
Hello, hello, listener. Once again, I'm in Croydon. We are precariously near a tram track. We heard all about the dangers of trams last week, but we also heard about some of the initiatives that are underway to promote Croydon and to perhaps get rid of the idea that has been prevalent for some while in some quarters that Croydon is anything other than an unalloyed delight. We're on the right side of the tracks. We've avoided the tram. Behind me is a pedestrian mall. Looking down the hill, and this could be quite a pleasant view. There's a church in the background. You can imagine that 50 years ago, this would have been almost countrified. Lots of shops. In fact, that's the one thing I can see absolutely everywhere is shops. This really is a retail centre. The other entity of which I'm aware is James Naylor. He's the editor-in-chief of the Croydon Citizen, which is both online and in paper form. And he is also the founder of Croydon Tours, which is where we come in.
Oh, hello.
Hello. We're ready to go. You very kindly offered to extend what was going to be a sort of 3 or 4 minute run around the town attempting to take in some of its delights into a full podcast.
Absolutely, indeed. So what I'm going to give you today is a taste of kind of the amazing history that Croydon has to offer, but not just its history, because the thing that really excites me, as much as being a tour guide in one part of my life, being the editor-in-chief of the Croydon Citizen in the other half, is actually the kind of amazing future that Croydon has, which I think is very much proved by actually lots of the really exciting things that have happened here before. So I will, as we go round, try and touch on some of those things as we go.
I feel it's beholden upon me to try and introduce some opposing arguments this week. In last week's episode, clearly we were in and amongst a group of people, yourself included, who are wanting to put forward a positive view of Croydon, and there's a lot to be positive about, that's quite clear. One of the ideas that comes across very strongly when talking about Croydon is that for a generation of people, it was a very unglamorous place to grow up in, and rather mundane, and not a lot to do, those sorts of things, a bit flat as an experience. And we're standing in the middle of a shopping precinct, which, if it weren't the sunny day that it is, well, it might not be the most exciting place in the world.
Definitely not. I mean, I think all shopping precincts are somewhat the same in that sense, that they are places where you get your shopping done, you maybe have a relaxing walk around, or you perhaps do your shopping, perhaps a bit of a day out, but they're not necessarily the world's most exciting places. Although I think actually, you might well agree with me that actually as you look about in Croydon today, you could see that it really is quite an amazing range of different things on offer though, all sort of from Main Street, High Street stores to sort of much smaller places, and a kind of an amazing array of different people as well that kind of call Croydon home. Not far from here as well, we also have an art gallery, which I hope we'll have a quick look at a bit later on the tour, and we have sort of some wonderful kind of independent coffee shops and the incredible Surrey Street Market as well, which is not only London's oldest continually operated street market, it's been here since 1276, but in fact still perhaps unlike many of London's kind of more sort of gentrified corporatized markets, is still very much a kind of real street market where you can find pretty much anything. So I think that's a great place to begin. Something I would like to say as well, as we're still in this very particular spot, which probably obviously your listeners can't see, but I shall try to describe to them, is some of that architectural diversity that I referred to before, that kind of is very symbolic of this Croydon spirit of putting one thing next to another, mixing it all in together, regardless of whether or not it's actually going to work. And I think that's very much the spirit of it. So obviously, last week we were speaking in the almshouses, which are just behind us. These Elizabethan almshouses, actually, as it happens, the best preserved Elizabethan almshouses in the country, and a Grade 1 listed building. Looking to the left, you have Alders, this fantastic sort of 1930s Oxford Street style shopfront. You've got 80s kind of postmodern architecture opposite in Debenhams, 60s Corbusianism at the Barclays. You have the medieval church that you mentioned already. You have one of my favourite buildings, which is the medieval KFC, which I think just captures the spirit of Croydon fantastically. You know, in a little cathedral city in the Shires, it would doubtless be a tea room, but here in Croydon, it's this very practical thing. It's a chicken shop.
I'm sorry to say that in a town in the Shires, it would still be a KFC.
Oh, well, quite possibly so, but this is, a fantastic kind of medieval building.
To linger on the KFC, yes, though, but I think one of the things that KFC does, I think I've noticed them doing this around the country, is that when they think that they have located their store in a town of historical merit, they introduce into their frontage a little bit of wood effect, a couple of little wood stripes there, which I think is their way of saying that they're trying to fit in.
Oh, that's a very interesting. Well, actually, I think that's a very good point. That is something where I think so many English towns, because their proposition is based fundamentally on being historical and twincy, if you will, that this becomes a really important thing. What I would say about this example is that actually all of those are real. So this is actually internally 15th century beams and 17th century weatherboarding on the outside as well, which hopefully we'll get a kind of closer look at as we walk down the hill here. So in very much all authentic.
And my former guest, Yannick Pucci, would be delighted to see the building on one of the corners here. It's curved and it is unmistakably deco.
Yes, absolutely fantastic. That kind of very classic deco style with these sort of almost neoclassical but very geometric columns up and down the building as well. Very much coming from a time in Croydon when it was actually a very, very wealthy place. And this is something I think that's kind of really interesting that's sort of forgotten now, is that until fairly recently, Croydon was actually very prosperous. And rather than being, as it is perhaps now, sometimes used as a sort of byword for sort of comparative suburban poverty, it was a very wealthy place where you had these kind of rather grandiose, actually high-status buildings.
My general impression, and I would have hesitated to have said it in the group environment in which we were last week, the place just needs tidying up a little bit. The architecture, as you say, is very rich and varied. There are a lot of the sorts of flourishes that you would, I guess, hope to see perhaps in a slightly classier sort of shopping area. For example, the clock sticking out there from 1884, the fact that there are trees in the shopping parade. You get the sense of flow as well going down the hill there. I think what seems to let the place down a little bit are the frontages.
So I think that's very true. I think a big part of it is about just keeping it tidier, keeping it nicer. But what I always say to people though is that, you know, when you're in Croydon, what you want to do is look up wherever you go, because when you look up, that's where you see that kind of really rich, incredible diversity. At the street level, what we need to do a lot more of is just keeping it clean, keeping it tidy. But that's not easy, because actually, you know, as you've probably already got great sense of here from the noise, the bustle, Croydon is this incredibly busy place that's kind of constantly in use, and what it's like is more like a miniature city. That's how busy this is. That's what a complex and challenging environment it is, but it's often managed like it's a small market town. And I think this you'll see as a kind of consistent theme as we walk around, that sort of the way that it's been historically perceived as this sort of commuter town out in the suburbs, fairly simple place, is actually quite out of step with the reality.
And if the listener has heard last week's episode, and I'd urge them to, they will have heard us talking about the perception gap. Maybe in the 90s, 2000s, a little bit of a change, certainly between the Second World War and the decline of those big industries that were going on in the area, through until maybe 10 or 15 years ago when things seemed to have started to change. Did Croydon just fail to keep up its PR message that, you know, this is what we're about?
I think it did, and I think for a kind of crucial period it failed to change. So I think the shift of the 1950s and 60s was absolutely profound. So when the Croydon Corporation Act was passed, it's a very unusual piece of legislation, a private member's bill in Parliament, that enabled Croydon Council to completely redraw the map of the whole town. Literally draw lines on it and say, right, all of these buildings are gone, they're going to be completely replaced with these buildings. And they were given the power by Parliament to do so. It went from being this very classic, fairly prosperous, relatively well-to-do Victorian commuter suburb into being this sort of mini Manhattan, as they referred to in its day. I must say, probably because most people hadn't been to New York at that point, I would say, but certainly this kind of this place that resembles a secondary American city in many ways, this sort of the heavy high-rise development that's just a few yards really from where we are right now. And the, part of the aim of that plan was to very much turn it into the classic working model of the time. So you have this sort of urban core where people commute into work, they leave in the evening, and then there's just nothing happening at night. And understandably, as you know, as culture changed in Britain, as working culture changed, people wanted to work in places more and more that were lively and exciting. Croydon actually got quite left behind, and sort of after hollowing itself out at night, it became this sort of strange, I guess, high-rise industrial park. And ultimately, that it never kind of really recovered from that. Well, you know, we've talked often about how, you know, I think there was a generation of people, probably a little older than myself, who grew up here and think of it primarily as boring. And I think that became a huge problem, because once all of those people who thought of it primarily as kind of boring began leaving, that's the word about Croydon that they took with them.
That's your creative brain drain as well. And it's also, those people seem to me more likely to have a platform for their views. If you're an aspiring presenter or artist or whatever, you're going to go out there and you're going to get your feelings about the town you used to live in known.
Exactly. And I think it became kind of, and ultimately, that's exactly it, because ultimately what happened was that Croydon became, for those people, a sort of byword for suburban boringness. And I think ultimately, this has a hugely negative effect, because those people had such a comparatively strong voice. There was a brilliant event that took place recently called Croydon Till I Die. And a group of national authors who've written about various themes about concrete development, the suburbs, etc., have come to Croydon to do a kind of series of talks, which they've actually also taken around the country, about what it's like to kind of grow up in the suburbs. And obviously when they came to Croydon, they focused it more on this subject matter, and that was very much the world they described. You know, all these chaps are now kind of in their sort of late 40s, and that's what they described. It was the kind of ultimate expression of this sort of the boring suburban place that you want to get away from in order to go to the bright lights of the big city. And I think that was tremendously damaging for Croydon.
Listener, you have been patient with me, or you've been cursing somebody's name for the last week, because we didn't answer in the last podcast the question of who of eminence has emerged from this town. I think this is a good moment to answer that question.
Absolutely. So we've got quite a lot of different famous Croydonians. So I'm going to avoid Kate Moss. Oh no, I've done it accidentally. But for example, we have lots of people who've been prominent in the arts. For example, a lot of people from the folk movement. So you have, for example, Kirsty MacColl, for example, folk singer, Ralph McTell, the great actress Peggy.
Ralph McTell's up. Didn't he moan about the streets of London as all?
Well, actually, that's very interesting, because actually he later felt that it described Croydon very well, and it's thought that he based most of those experiences actually on Croydon, not on London. But he wanted the song to have a kind of wider appeal, which is why he chose Streets of London as a title.
But I interrupted your list.
Well, yes, absolutely. We have the great kind of actress Peggy Ashcroft, for example, and in addition to this, the artist Sam Taylor Wood as well, also from Croydon. It's actually got a lot of kind of connections with the arts in general, but almost more interesting than the people that are sort of just from Croydon, and the people that have lived here at various points in time. And I think that's something that's really important to mention. Population of Croydon really exploded in the 19th century as it became a kind of one of these sort of archetypal London suburbs in many ways. But, and the number of people who, as a result, ended up calling Croydon home because it was convenient and it was absolutely fantastic. So you've got, for example, D.H. Lawrence taught here in Addiscombe. You have Arthur Conan Doyle also lived here in Croydon. And indeed, one of my favourite stories about that is the fact that it was after he'd killed Holmes at the Reichenbach Falls that he wanted to, because he was tired of the character, that he wanted to go back to practising optometry, which he did here in Croydon, which is fantastic.
And I happen to know that Croydon gets mentioned in a Sherlock Holmes story as well.
Yes, indeed it does. Well, of course, because again, at the time, Croydon would have been, there would have been some countryside still between London and Croydon at the time. And being an area where lots of sort of relatively well-to-do merchant types would live in order to commute into town. So again, absolutely archetypal place for some mysteries to take place.
We're at a crossroads. Which branch are we going to take?
So I think what we're going to do is we're actually going to walk down Crown Hill, and we're going to walk into what's known as the Old Town, which was really the core of medieval Croydon. So pretty much the town up until really the 17th century was bounded in a kind of triangle, perhaps only at its maximum length, maybe sort of 700 yards or so, that we're sort of entering right now, which is actually quite far from East Croydon Station. It's a good sort of 10-minute walk away from the main station for the town now. And at the heart of this is Surrey Street Market, which, as I mentioned, is actually London's oldest continuously operated street market, and would once have been part of a kind of network of lots and lots and lots of tiny streets in this area. So we're coming up to the medieval KFC that I mentioned before, and we can see some of the 17th century weatherboarding that exists on the side of this building as we walk into a tiny little street called Bell Hill. So if you just kind of take a look up there, you can see this. I particularly like this because it gives me the impression of a Kentish village rather than, you know, the heart of downtown Croydon. And then if we walk a little bit further along as well, and this is difficult to see in the kind of bright sunshine that we have today, but if you look up, you can actually see some of the medieval beams that make up the interior now inside the upstairs dining area of the KFC.
Yes.
This is a kind of great part of town to visit because there are just a few of these architectural survivals that are left. As we sort of discussed before, Croydon went through a massive planning redevelopment in the 1950s, and it was primarily that rather than the Luftwaffe that resulted in Croydon being the modernist building that it is today. I think a lot of people assume that bombing was primarily the cause, because no one can imagine that a town would do this to itself. But actually, Croydon has this real history of massive reinvention, because where we're standing right now was part of an earlier redevelopment at the end of the 19th century, where the medieval town, which was pretty much completely existent with some buildings dating back to the 14th century at the time, was pretty much wiped off the map and replaced with a completely new grid plan. And this was actually the kind of the first one of kind of Croydon's major reinventions.
Can I just ask you about those swinging changes? Were they reckless?
I think they are a bit reckless. I think there's something fundamentally a little bit reckless about Croydon as a place. You know, when we were standing at the top of the hill looking at the kind of variety of different architecture, the thing that's kind of really obvious about it is how little concern there is for things tastefully fitting in to an existing plan. You know, so much of British architecture is about we must make this sure that this tastefully fits into the area. We're going to have slow, conservative change. And Croydon kind of rejects all that. One of the things that I often talk about is on my tour at that particular point is how Croydon is in many ways the anti-Bath. Rather than having this sort of beautifully consistent, very, very conceived as a whole centre, instead it is this crazy hotspot of different things, and that are the result of occasionally deciding suddenly to wipe the slate clean and rebuild, and generally the motives of this are nearly always very pure. For example, this medieval town was a fetid and really disease-ridden place. Where we are now, there are probably about four or five major streets. There were as many as 150 tiny alleyways and streets before. This was a breeding ground for cholera, for disease. So when the Victorians reinvented this, they were thinking of it purely from a sanitation point of view. They were improving people's lives. That was the result. It did improve hygiene locally. They probably were less concerned and were not thinking about the kind of impact that this completely changed environment would have on people. And although the ironic thing is today, I think, you know, looking around these medieval and Victorian streets, we would actually say this is rather charming, perhaps compared to the 1950s reconception of what the town should be further up the hill. But nonetheless, again, was done with that kind of like clear sort of very positive aims, but perhaps with not always the greatest consideration to long-term impact.
I get the impression that another difference between the Victorian and the present-day outlook in terms of planning might be that there was a sort of a paternalistic, we know what's best for you, conception of the common man and woman. Whereas now I think we're much more consumption units, and drawing people to the town and facilitating them buying stuff is a higher priority.
Yes, I think so. And actually that kind of reflects all the kind of focus of a lot of major developments. So if you looked at the sort of 60s development, it was primarily about how can we build a huge office centre primarily. I mean, we're talking about the construction in the space of 10 years of 50 major office buildings, about 7 or 8 million square feet of offices, where there had only been a couple of such buildings before. You can kind of see it in the image of sort of the that time of in the 1960s of early computing, of different production units moving between different places, and it was simply more efficient to have the production units based in the suburbs closer to where they live than have them based in central London. So I think that was very much driving the philosophy of the design as people within this large machine. And I guess again today the one fear we sometimes have about some of the new commercial development, which I must admit very much in favour of, is that it is precisely the consumption units you mentioned, that we're like, well, this is primarily about capturing retail spend from a wide catchment area rather than necessarily, you know, what is best in general for the common man, as you say. I think when we see the pump house just around the corner from where we are now, you're going to see probably the greatest single physical expression of that ideology.
We've just emerged into the Market Street.
Yes, this is indeed the Surrey Street Market, the one that, as I said, has been here for many, many hundreds and hundreds of years.
To our left, there's a colonnade that really reminds me of the Wild West.
Yes, it has that kind of feel to it, doesn't it? This is actually, again, one of the sort of rare 18th century survivals of a building. And if you look up upwards, you can actually see quite a lot of hooks along that were originally, there would have been butcher's hooks hanging for various meat. This was actually known at one point as as Butcher's Alley, because it was just completely, or Butcher's Row, because there was so much meat being sold here at the end of the market. Actually, one time on one of my tours, I had a 93-year-old lady come on the tour, very intrepid. She remembers in her youth still there being literally just people hanging in the middle of the street now, it's unimaginable, large joints of meat and blood literally running down the street. Again, not quite the sanitised perspective that we have today.
Where are we heading?
So we're going to go along Surrey Street. We'll try and weave our way through it. As you can see, one of the great things about this market is it's actually still really kind of quite thriving. Not what it once was. It was even once busier and larger than this, and it's obviously been hit by all the changes that markets have, you know, with the rise of the supermarket, local metro stores, etc. But you'll get a sense of this. And what I'll try to do is point out a couple of kind of notable buildings on the way through before we go to our next major destination, which will be the pumping station.
Well, it's good to see that the market is still not only existing, but as you say, thriving. There are porters with big boxes of stuff on their shoulder passing us by, barrows with the equipment necessary for making the market stalls, and more punnets of tomatoes than you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. As we're going through, I'll just take a chance to point out two really great buildings. So in front of me, you've got the really fantastic, very well-preserved 18th century pub, the Dog and Bull. That's one of Croydon's quite a few centrally located Grade 2 listed buildings. Again, you can see lots of the original features there. Absolutely fantastic. And then across the way, just looking back at the colonnaded building you mentioned earlier, where we actually now have, you can just see there's a Polish supermarket there. Actually, is an interesting piece of recent cultural history, is regarded as one of the arguable birthplaces of dubstep. This used to be the Big Apple Records store where two members of Magnetic Man, Benga and Scream, actually created some of the first dubstep sounds as well. So again, part of that kind of rich lineage of Croydon being a place for a lot of cultural genesis, although admittedly what then sometimes happens is people often move away.
Well, let's track on through. We're in the way of people going about real business here.
Absolutely we are, yes. We'll have to, as I said, weave our way through this market. It's not easy. This is a bit quieter than normal, if anything. It's not often easy to get a whole tour group of 20 people through here, I can tell you.
How long have you been touring?
So I've been touring now for about 3.5 years. So I'm not a hugely venerable in that sense, I guess, tour guide. But I started the whole thing really because I've always had a bit of a passion for history. And at some point after living in central Croydon for about a year, I kind of just started falling in love with it. And it, to me, it just seemed like a very obvious move to take that kind of love of local history, a bit of performance as well. I'm a bit of a performer, and then and show people this much maligned place that was actually really fascinating, and that's kind of what brought me to it really.
We are approaching. Well, it won't surprise you, listener, to know that this is a bridge that is in a unique, in its context, architectural style. It is a bridge that's shiny underneath, so that you can have a look at your bald spot, and the market below, which stretches on.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic place. And as you say, a rather unique, sort of highly reflective bridge above us as well. Again, connecting that the fact that we're one thing that this hides, this area is on a very, very steep slope. And so you've got the kind of a lot of different roads built at different levels.
Extra salt sacks here, 20 more pounds.
Where's that voice coming from? Is that the hygiene goods fellow over there?
Yeah, exactly.
He had me in his beady gaze, I think very deliberately advertising his wares to a wider audience.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, you can't blame him for a bit of free marketing now, can you?
All I ever understand when I go through a market is a pound. I go, oh, well, there's something for a pound.
Pound a pound, that's generally the one thing that you kind of get very clearly.
Well, we turn the corner and there is a rather twee-looking... I'm gonna have a guess at this. I'm going to say this has something to do with one of the Victorian decorative styles that fell out of favour.
Absolutely it does. So this is indeed the aforementioned pumping station.
But we should say that it looks far more like... it's castellated for a start. It looks far more like a castle in the early Victorian Arthurian style than it does anything else.
I think it absolutely does, although I'm tempted to think there's something of a slight kind of almost Moroccan influence on it. It has this sort of slight, almost Byzantine kind of look, the way you have these arches that look very... very kind of Eastern, actually.
Can we say, before we say anything else, it's ridiculous if this is a pumping station.
Absolutely.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Absolutely. Well, this is actually something which is actually not... This is, although a brilliant building and a unique building in itself, was not a unique trend in Victorian times. We talked before about that idea of this celebration of kind of municipal aims, of the idea of building these really important structures for the public good. And often when they were built in these rather wonderful, grandiose, over-the-top styles. There's a similar kind of... Again, it looks physically very different, but a similarly over-the-top building in Wapping, where... It was a pumping station there, and also one, for example, at Streatham as well. This was quite a kind of common trend to have these buildings that really celebrated that kind of municipal achievement. The Croydon one is particularly important because it's a building which is actually, it was one of the very first such buildings to be constructed. So in fact, Croydon was the first place in the country to form a municipal sanitation board.
So this is sewage pumping, or is it water pumping?
This is actually providing clean water. So obviously, we've just come out of the old town area, which, as I said, was crisscrossed by lots of tiny streets, was pretty unhygienic, didn't really have access to proper clean water. So it was quite a priority to provide people with clean water. And where we're standing right now is a huge underground water source, quite close to the River Wandle, which was actually pumped from underneath where we are right now all the way up to Park Hill and then distributed by gravity all around Croydon. Now, they formed this municipal board in Waterford in 1848, and that's the earliest example of that in the country, and for example, significantly predates Bazalgette's construction of sewers and sanitation in central London, for example. And this is just another example of how Croydon, particularly in engineering, has often led the way. And I guess a celebration of this, they wanted to construct something that was really, really impressive. And so you have this castle-like building in front of us.
There's something rather odd going on as well around it. We've taken a step through between two buildings and we find ourselves in the courtyard, I suppose you'd have to call it, around the pumping station. There are one or two places there. There's a pizza place that may be boarded up. And a number of pretend shop fronts, you know, the kind when they can't sell the shop or the shop is yet to come, so they pretend there's a shop there. But in spite of the fact that we can see the bustling market from where we are, there's not a soul around us. It's rather eerie.
It's very strange. So one of the kind of the big themes of Croydon in the last 30 years is that it has consistently missed its timing. Or its timing has been terrible. So in 2007, this square was built, was constructed, big renovation of the old telephone exchange building, which we can also see on our left as well, turned into luxury flats, a plan to make the pumping station into a kind of general kind of entertainment complex, maybe some kind of gastro pub. You can kind of picture it now in the developers' minds as to what it would have been. And of course, in 2008, the developer went bust. The entire economy went bust, and the money never came to fruition to actually make the development happen. So it's kind of another example of where this really great idea that something in Croydon had never really fully materialised.
It's tantalisingly close, isn't it?
It's tantalisingly close now. Due to a series of strange legal complications, this area was owned by the Irish government for quite some time, who didn't really...
I'm learning not to be surprised.
Which was as a result of a various series of bank foreclosures, ultimately on the Bank of Ireland itself. And the ultimate result of this was that they had no particular interest really in lots of sort of very local detailed development. They were interested in just selling it on. It has now been sold on, and it's expected that it will emerge soon as some sort of venue. So the early parts of this is that we've started, I mentioned in the previous podcast, this street art gallery that's being created. And so around us now, gradually, the panels of these sort of fake shops that were put in about 8 years ago are beginning to be replaced with sort of works of urban art instead. And there is some talk, particularly of these units finally being opened up as well and shops moving in. And there is one such place already that's joined us, which is the really fantastic coffee shop / art gallery / workspace / burger bar Matthew's Yard, which is just opposite us here, which is sort of the first kind of thing to open on the square, and hopefully it will eventually be followed. But as you say, it's certainly very quiet today.
Exclusive, I think.
Yes, exclusive. That would be the property developer's term for it, anyway.
I just want to go off-piste a little bit and just pop our noses out down behind the pumping station there. The thing that's attracted my attention is the sort of thing I had in mind when Croydon was first mooted as a podcast destination. This looks like high brutalist to me. If this wasn't built in the 60s, then I'll eat my hat.
Absolutely, yeah. This is the monumental, is one way to describe it, BT telephone exchange, which dates from, in fact, a little bit later than that, about 1972.
That's a hat job.
Yeah, and what it is, it's this, like I say, it's the local telephone exchange, one of the most important telephone exchanges for the South East, and was just sort of built right on the edge of the town centre next to lots of, as we can see here, tiny two-storey Victorian housing with sort of almost no sort of question as to context at all.
It's a bit communist, isn't it?
It really is. Well, there's a story that goes that I must admit, to say up front, is probably a myth, that Croydon was number one on the Soviet Union's list of nuclear targets, not because they despised the architecture, but because by nuking this particular telephone exchange, you would take out communications across the southeast, because it's an important hub. I don't know who's seen these records, who could make this kind of who would access this highly top secret information. But I think it's a sort of wonderful story that highlights particularly why this particular exchange was here.
As an aside to an aside, I've seen what purports to be a genuine handbook outlining the Nazi invasion plans in the early 40s, and they detail all the various buildings and towns that they intend to take over and precisely why. It makes for fascinating reading, as you see the EMI record headquarters being turned into the Ministry of Propaganda, etc. Which direction would you say will bear the most fruit.
So I think it would be great to just wander a little bit down here just to see a little bit of the Croydon Palace and also talk a little bit about John Ruskin's associations with Croydon.
We have teamed up with audible.co.uk to offer you a free audiobook of your choice. All you have to do is register for 1 month free trial to claim your free audiobook. There are over 150,000 to choose from. The 30-day free trial means you can choose a free audiobook, which is yours to keep whether or not you decide to cancel in the trial period. And there's more good news. If you trialed the service over 12 months ago, the good people at Audible are giving you a chance to get your hands on another audiobook for free. So sign up at www.audible.co.uk/Londonist.
You're listening to Londonist Out Loud. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and with me is James Naylor, who, his job title has been upgraded while we've been taking that word from our sponsor, Audible. I've spoken to somebody connected with Matthew's Yard. I said my tour guide was James Naylor, and he said, ah, yes, the unofficial mayor of Croydon.
Well, he's probably being too kind. I do have that reputation just sometimes.
There's a bit of a love-in going on here.
It's a little bit of a Croydon love-in. Well, I think that's partly the result of, certainly a few years ago, there were quite a lot of people, primarily kind of through Twitter, who kind of got to know each other in the local area, wanting to sort of make a bit of a difference. You know, we've talked before about the kind of great community activity that there is around. And that, I think, very much manifested initially as a sort of comparatively small group of people who kind of knew each other, all had the kind of common aim of just getting more involved, getting people more excited, doing more exciting things locally. So as a result, there's still quite a kind of little network of us, even though it's now grown a lot, far beyond that. And I'm constantly hearing about new projects where I've never met the people involved, which is really nice. That's certainly kind of where that emerged from.
We should linger very briefly on our sponsor's message, which is that if you are new to Audible, if you haven't tried it out yet, and you're into words being poured into your ears in the fashion that we are demonstrating currently, but perhaps in story form, also in non-fiction form, then Audible could well be for you. It's an audio book service, a perfect thing if you're sitting in your car or wandering around enjoying the sunshine. And the URL is www.audible.co.uk/Londonist. If you sign up for a free trial, and that's a 30-day free trial, no obligation to buy anything, you'll get a free book and it's yours to keep, and that doesn't stop when the trial stops. But if you like it, and you will, then for a very small monthly fee, you get extra audiobooks, which are also yours to keep and enjoy at your leisure. If you've already signed up more than 12 months ago, then another free one awaits you. And if that were the case with James Naylor, then the title he would be picking would be what?
It would be Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. That probably is my favourite novel, and that will take some time to listen to. It's about 1,000 pages in print, but that would certainly be my pick.
That's what I really love about Audible, actually. I use it all the time, and they don't give you abridged versions. You get the full, whatever it might be, 12 hours, 20 hours. I've genuinely got War and Peace unabridged from Audible. And, you know, you get this monthly token thing with them, and one of my monthly tokens got me the complete works of Arthur Conan Doyle.
Oh, absolutely fantastic. That's absolutely great, yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's return our focus to Croydon, and we're going to drift out into the sunshine. We really picked a good day for it, didn't we?
Yeah, absolutely. We're very lucky today with the weather.
Is it always like this in Croydon?
Well, much as I would like to say it's always sunny in Croydon, even I can't really stretch on that one. We've been quite fortunate today, and I'm just very glad that it's such wonderful skies.
I'm assuming you are yourself a Croydonian.
Yes, so I grew up not too far from here, in the very south of our borough, in a place called Coolston. Then I moved away with my parents, they moved to Somerset. And to be honest with you, I had no expectation of coming back. I thought, you know, Croydon, that's just where I grew up. Bright lights, big city is where I want to go. I don't really want to hang around here. Then I was running my own business at the time, and I was looking for a sort of affordable place to be based. And it was suggested to me, well, why don't you just try Croydon for a bit? Because you know it, you'll get a good cheap deal, right? So I sort of thought, okay, I'll give this a shot. And so about 5 years ago, I moved back in, and somehow in the first year of living here, and I'm not really sure exactly when or how it happened, I kind of fell in love with it. And I suddenly realised that this place that I'd perhaps, you know, come in on the bus to do a bit of shopping and not really much else when I was a child, it was actually this really quite amazing place that had lots of exciting things going on, people that wanted to do exciting things, and a kind of really rich history. And I think that's how it grew on me.
And we should say a word as well about the Croydon Citizen.
Well, absolutely we should. So I'd been running the tours for a little while, kind of getting my message out there, I felt, a little bit, and talking to people about it. And I thought what was required and was really something that was a bit broader in a remit, a sort of discussion forum, I guess, that would engage people on kind of more interesting subjects and some of the kind of genuine problems and challenges we face. I mean, there's kind of no getting away from the fact that Croydon does have some kind of, you know, some sort of serious various social issues as well as a kind of an image problem. So what we wanted to do was create a kind of citizen-driven platform for that by creating a kind of truly citizen-driven newspaper. So ordinary people writing stuff, a team of editors would then workshop and then develop in order to produce it to a kind of truly publishable standard. A kind of fusion of, I guess, a traditional newspaper with blogging. And the Citizen resulted. People loved it, and we were able to do it pretty quickly, you know, a year after we launched online, a crowdfunding campaign to take it into print. And we've been in print now since, I guess, the very end of 2013.
And I picked up my festival copy, and it's a good-looking beast. There was an article that caught my eye on the back of this latest edition, which I think was, correct me if I'm wrong, 20 reasons to be cheerful about Croydon, or something of that sort.
Yes, 20 reasons that Croydon isn't boring, which I... which was actually a response to an article that I wrote, where I actually said that I had a piece calling for Croydon to make it less boring, because I'm of the strong belief that actually a kind of thriving cultural life that just makes people's lives more interesting is what the kind of town needed more than anything else. Only to be then robustly proven wrong, to even suggesting that there was a lack of such a thing by one of our readers, who then put together a kind of BuzzFeed-style list of the 20 kind of exciting things that are already happening here, quite against what I'd said.
Buzz being the operative word here. Number 13, Croydon beekeepers. Bees have been around for over 100 million years, and I bet you've never seen a bored, I bet you've never seen a bored bee. Croydon beekeepers welcomes new members and visitors to its apiary in Purley, where the award-winning honey is produced.
Well, exactly. That's what I love about this list, is the sort of thing you'd find that it might be an interesting coffee shop, it might be a kind of an art collective, or it might be a group of beekeepers. I mean, you really will kind of find everything. That's the mixed bag that is Croydon.
We're going to go and find something. What are we going to find?
So we're just going to walk a little bit down the street here to talk briefly about the River Wandle, which would be good, and then hopefully just see a little bit of the Croydon Palace.
Now, we mentioned before that the area we passed through was significantly underused at the time we passed through it. Somebody has decided to remedy that by creating some metalwork looking like shoppers.
Yes, this is a very interesting sort of little project to create a series of bronze sculptures where you have three kind of famous or adopted Croydonians. So you have Peggy Ashcroft, the actress, and sitting on one side. You have Ronnie Barker, who I should note is not from Croydon. Ronnie Corbett.
None of those are Ronnie Barker.
None of those are Ronnie Barker. You're quite right. Sorry. We have Ronnie Corbett, who is, of course, not from Croydon, but has actually lived here for a very long period of time because, you know, he likes it so much as a place to live. And then also Britain's first kind of black composer and foremost, Samuel Coleridge Taylor. He wrote his kind of opera Hiawatha, and actually it was an unfinished opera of his recently. It was performed at the Fairfield Halls. His music still delighting many people. Another one of those sort of adopted Croydonians was obviously the foremost cultural critic, John Ruskin, who a lot of people don't realise is associated with Croydon. They're probably just a bit mystified by the fact that there's a few Ruskin houses, various Ruskin schools about. His family were actually from Croydon, and his mother came from a family of publicans who owned a pub here, and he actually spent a lot of time here as a child. He actually writes his autobiography that one of his kind of favourite activities was playing in and around the River Wandle and all the still ponds that used to sit around there, which on a day like this would have been very beautiful, the sort of by the riverbanks. And he said that the experience of playing in those ponds by this River Wandle and looking back to the low red roofs of Croydon was one of the most powerful influences on his entire notion of aesthetics. And I like this because the idea that Croydon positively influenced the aesthetics of possibly the world's most famous architectural critic is again kind of one of those things about how this town has played this sort of quiet but important role in throughout history.
The street that we're on now, if you're following, I never know whether to give street names. I wonder whether there might be somebody out there who likes to know exactly what junction we're on. Assuming that for some strange reason you do, we're on the junction of Charles Street and Howley Road right now. And this is a very calming feeling street. It's very suburban in feel, terraced houses.
Yes, and I think this is and interesting because, of course, up until the end of the 19th century, this was pretty much entirely those still Wandle Ponds that John Ruskin used to play in. And it was only really redeveloped in a sort of large scale all with one go at the end of the 19th century. And again, it's this classic thing where it's this street of very ordinary Victorian terraces that run right up against giant brutalist telephone exchange, the pump house that we've just come from, again all sort of wonderfully thrown together. And it also hides the fact that just behind here you have the Grade 1 listed palace, which we're about to have a look at now.
I'm trying to imagine looking at this little semi-detached cottage here, a very modest two-story thing. I'm imagining that one day you get the letter through the door from the council mentioning that they're going to be building something just on the other side of the street. And you think, OK, yeah, I mean, we could there's a bit of space there, we could do so. And this 14-storey, hard-edged monstrosity starts to emerge.
It must have been pretty shocking. I mean, to be honest, based on the planning policies of the time in which the council were empowered to just pretty much wipe the slate clean, I'd be surprised if they even got a letter, to be honest, to tell them that it was even happening before this giant building suddenly emerged out of nowhere.
So you think they just opened the curtains one morning, oh, Derek, come to the window, you're not going to like this.
And yes, exactly. I think that's probably pretty much how it happened.
Away we go, down a similar sort of terrace here. And there are trees abounding at the bottom of the short street. Have we got any Croydon facts that aren't easily going to fit in? We've got a very short walk to fill here.
Oh, absolutely. So trying to think of what the sort of best Croydon facts that sort of fit in. I guess for me, one of the ones that's kind of, again, forgotten, but it's another industrial first, is that actually Croydon is the site of the world's first public railway of any kind. So that was the Surrey Iron Railway that ran from Croydon to Wandsworth. It was built in 1802. So it actually...
1802?
Yes. It predates the steam locomotive. So it was actually a horse-drawn railway, but it's the first time in the world when anyone had the idea of constructing a railway where you would then allow lots of different freight to be carried on it. So things like railways with inside mines had already existed, for example, but actually as a major route connecting two places, this is the first one of its kind in the world.
On the way down on the train, I noticed that there were quite a few stretches of railway arches that were being, I wasn't sure if they're being entirely demolished, but certainly they were having a lot of their structure knocked apart. Is that part of that original railway system?
Yes, part of it is. I mean, so Croydon really exploded in population as a result of the railway. So to give you an idea of the change and the scale of change, in 1805, Croydon's population was 5,000. Again, you know, relatively decent size for a town of the era, you know, by no means small. By 1905, it was 135,000. And that's how much the town had completely exploded and was transformed from prosperous market town into this huge commuter suburb. And primarily because it was such a centre for the railway. So this is the point where the main lines from London Bridge and Victoria meet to make the main Brighton line down to the coast. It was the point where the Surrey Iron Railway had already existed up to Wandsworth and numerous other routes connected. I mean, the tram link that we talked about a bit is actually built on lots of former railway lines, part of that cluster around Croydon. So it became an obvious site for engineering, for example, and lots of engineering firms kind of took off in the second half of the 19th century in Croydon as a result. So the railway has always been really important to the local area. We're now arriving on the corner here, and I think it's really quite a surprise. You suddenly walk out of this very ordinary terrace street and you're suddenly facing an Archbishop's Palace. And in fact, if you just look across the street we're going to walk across now, you'll see, for example, immediately a genuine 15th century half-timbered building, very rare for completely wooden buildings like that to even survive. This brilliant 18th century brick long gallery that encases the original Tudor long gallery where Elizabeth I danced with John Whitgift, and then, which we can't see because of the sheer quantity of foliage right now, but just behind this, the medieval Great Hall as well of the building, which is, as we turn around the corner, we'll get a slightly closer look at. This is probably, if I have to pick a favourite, maybe even over the almshouse, is my favourite building in Croydon, because it's just such a revelation. And you just can't imagine that this is only a 10-minute walk from the sort of high-rise Alphaville that sits a kind of atop the hill where most of Croydon's office buildings are, and the most recognisable site from the train, that you have this sort of oasis of calm that sort of resembles a sort of very attractive National Trust property.
Mm, yeah, arches of roses over the door there. I don't know if it's just because of the context in which we tend to find them, but there seems always to be something very restful about the early Tudor architectural style.
Yeah, there is. I think it's, I guess, compared to the sort of comparatively very muscular and brutal scale of medieval architecture, it was a lot homelier, smaller scale, more human scale, and it had that sense. There's still a kind of quiet grandeur to a lot of it, but not as imposing, perhaps. I guess because its aim was more built around livability and less about sort of imposing symbolism like a great cathedral would be.
Well, we're coming to the end of our tour, I suspect.
We are indeed.
I was determined not to sound cheesy about this. It has successfully transformed any preconceptions I had of Croydon.
Oh, well, then my job is done.
I suppose there's one question left that I haven't addressed, and I realise I should, with this being the Londonist Out Loud podcast. Is Croydon London?
Croydon is now London. And I think that's the kind of crucial thing. It suffered from an identity crisis for a very long period of time. So when it was the market town in the middle of the countryside with a fair distance between it and London, it was a separate place. But particularly in the 20s and 30s, as London suburbs exploded like never before, and you have the whole kind of interwar housing, the gap did close completely. But it took a long time for people to recognise that Croydon effectively, economically, it was already independent. There was no countryside left between it and the town, and most people who lived in Croydon worked in London. It took a long time to realise that it was part of London, and even though it officially became so in the 1960s, even today you'll find a lot of people in Croydon who will plead that Croydon is very much Surrey. But I think, as we've explored today, Croydon does not look very much like Surrey. It has none of the properties and characteristics of what we associate with Surrey. The reality is that now it is this mini metropolis inside a mega metropolis. It is a intrinsic part of London. It will always retain its own special identity as this little centre unto itself. But the reality is, the when it comes to culture, to people, to economics, all of those things, it's very much part of London, and I think it benefits hugely from being that. So I'm very much one to celebrate that as being just one really fantastic part of a really amazing world city.
If I add anything else, I shall be reducing the impact of that final flourish. James Naylor, thanks very much indeed.
You're very welcome. Thank you. My heart aches for some
far off place, no one cut it. And that is all for this week. My thanks for this week to James Naylor. Thanks too to Chris Baker, Mark Barr and Bernie Barkley. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.